This is Justice Radio. This episode follows our previous three-part series about surviving harm and the relationship between accountability, healing, and justice in our criminal legal system. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College and the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative. Today, I'm going to be talking with Martina Cartman and Devin Adams, who are the co-founders of Collective Justice, which is based in Washington State. In previous episodes of the Survivors series, we've interviewed other members of the Collective Justice staff on their work leading community accountability and restorative justice processes in the wake of harm. Their work is amazing, and we in Maine feel really privileged to have this opportunity for three conversations that will allow us to learn about how Collective Justice does what Collective Justice does. So today's conversation is going to focus on Collective Justice itself. What does the organization do? How and why was it founded? What does it offer to those who have both caused harm and those who have experienced harm? And could something like common justice be replicated here in Maine with the specificities that we have in Maine in our particular version of the criminal legal system? So Martina, I'm going to come to you first, and I'm going to ask you to describe for us, what is Collective Justice? What are your goals? What's your vision for the organization?
Thank you, Catherine, and thank you so much for having us here today. It's an honor and pleasure to talk to you again. Yeah, I think I'd start by saying Collective Justice is a living organism that has grown and shifted over the last few years, but we are fundamentally an org that is rooted in restorative and transformative justice. So big picture goal is that we want to shrink systems of punishment and grow community and healing-based responses to harm. We believe that it's possible to challenge and mass incarceration, to challenge criminal justice as it currently exists, and to stop interpersonal violence at the same time, and that those two projects depend on each other. They're not separate from one another or in opposition. We're a collective of sorts and a 501c3 nonprofit where we have staff and facilitation teams and members. We started out very small, and we are experimenting with sort of non-traditional structures, organizational structures, and learning lots and lots about that along the way.
Thanks. I'm really curious to hear about this organizational structure, because I think probably our listeners are very familiar with the standard 501c3, where you have to have a board, and then you have an ED, and then you have, you know, a hierarchical staff. Your structure is different. And so, Devin, can I come to you and ask you to explain to us a little bit more about the way that you've structured Collective Justice and why you've structured it that way?
Yeah, sure. I think best model that people may be familiar with is a worker co-op. In the beginning, it was very organic, just Martina in community, working with folks that she was in relationship with and wanting to build out a program. And so doing that, ultimately hiring on more people and not wanting to follow traditional hierarchical structures, because we understand how that can be harmful. And so just thinking about, okay, we're going to be, you know, folks are running programs, some are going to do operations work, things like that. And then we worked with some consultants and kind of settled on a worker co-op, worked with Dean Spade at the Sylvia Rivera Law Institute. They gave us a lot of great information on how to run like a horizontal structure. And I think there's growing pains with that. You know, when you start out small, it's very easy to kind of make decisions and manage. And then as you begin to grow and the work begins to grow, there's challenges. And how do you how do decisions get made? What is the process? Who needs to be involved in the conversation? And I think those are conversations that we're moving through now, but ultimately wanting it to be true to the name of the organization, Collective Justice. Right. And wanting to have as much input from community and folks that are invested in this work in deciding how we move as a community.
Thanks. I love that. I think a lot of us who are involved in restorative justice, transformative justice, abolitionist work are really eager and interested in learning how to build organizations that can move forward the transformative work we want to move forward, have a decision-making structure that works, actually, you know, be functional in that way, but not reproduce the sort of harmful hierarchies that we all don't view as abolitionist. And right. It's really a super, super hard challenge. And I remember the first time coming to your offices and having that conversation with you and just leaving with my jaw on the floor about how you were figuring that out and putting that together. And the fact that you have, if I recall correctly, a person whose job it is to do what I would call organizational hygiene, you know, just sort of the wellness of the staff, the successful ability to maintain internal forms of communication and decision making. And I just thought that was a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's our collective wellness director. We have two folks holding it right now. Martina's holding a lot of that work along with another staff member, and they're our collective wellness team. So, yeah, they're the organizational hygienists.
Yeah, everybody needs a collective wellness team. That's fabulous. I love that. Yeah. Devin, let's continue with you. I'm interested in hearing about your personal backgrounds, whatever you're willing to share with us and our listeners. What brought you to restorative justice as your current praxis? And, you know, I feel like in watching your organization, your life commitment, how did you get here? And if you could start that by defining for our listeners what restorative justice is for you.
Okay, for me, restorative justice is how are we in relationship with each other in a way that isn't punitive, that is loving, that sees the humanity in everyone, sees the value and the importance of everyone. And when harm occurs, when conflict occurs, that we have the skills and the tools to move through that and actually strengthen relationship and build out these systems that allow us to strengthen our relationships individually and with community. And I think even deeper, like even within ourselves. And I think that's really where my story starts is, you know, as a young person experiencing trauma, experiencing violence, not having the skills to move through that, not knowing how to respond to violence without responding in violence, because I didn't have the tools I needed, which ultimately ended me, resulted in me going to prison. And I was sentenced to a 30-year term for causing serious harm. I took the life of a man. It was something that, you know, I still move through, like right now, just thinking about it, a lot of shame associated with it, and it was senseless. And I found myself in prison asking myself, how did I get to this point where I could cause this level of harm? And immediately when I was in prison at the beginning, I was fortunate enough to be at a prison where there was elders around me that were a part of prison organizations, the Black Prisoners Caucus and the Concerned Lifers Organization. And these men loved on me and cared on me, and community members were coming in and sharing with us. And what it showed me was the power of community to help heal. And they saw my value when I didn't see it. And eventually over time, I worked myself into leadership roles in these organizations. And the term specifically restorative justice hadn't really come up. I'd spent a lot of time working on improvement within the prison, legal legislation and things like that, and working on the education system in community, and then realized that my relationship with accountability really was, it was messed up. It was all based in punishment. And so a lot of us felt the same way. We wanted to change this narrative that people in prison don't care about their community. They don't care about the people that they've harmed. And simultaneously, Martina was doing a work unbeknownst to a lot of us in the prison at the Black Prisoners Caucus and Concerned Lifers Organization. But there was a connection that we both had, which was a sponsor named Catherine Beckett. And she brought Martina in, and we started to explore what it would look like to have a restorative justice process inside a prison. And that was my introduction to the work. And I was a part of HEAL, which is an acronym for Healing, Education, for Accountability and Liberation. And Martina can talk about that a little bit, and I can build on it. But ultimately, it was a 18-month program or process where I was able to learn about what RJ was, and it allowed me to learn about myself, to learn about my traumas, to learn how to move through my traumas, how to actually be accountable, and what it meant to grieve and to do all the things and to figure out my own emotions and to tend with those and to show up in a better way and be in better relationship with myself and my community. And I think once you do that, you realize there's no end goal, right? There's no end goal to healing. There's no end game to any of this. And so it does require a lifelong commitment to healing and practicing. And so I always tell people, well, you know, I'm just in practice. I'm trying to be better than I was yesterday. Some days are better than others. But I'm committed to this way of living because it's the only way that we can really reduce, get the communities that we want to see, build the communities and responses that we want to see. For me, RJ is the way to do that.
Thank you, Devin. That's incredibly powerful. And I especially appreciate the line that you draw between changing the narrative that prisoners don't care about the harm they caused to a program that gave you a space and support for doing that sort of hard internal work, a deep dive into your own historic traumas that led you in the direction of how to actually be accountable. So how to actualize in real practice the caring about the harm you might have caused and showing others how to do the same thing. That's the clear through line here that's so, so, so important and so, so, so hard. Martina, let's turn to you. What brought you into that prison to meet with Devin so you two could build this organization together?
Yeah, it feels like just yesterday and also so long ago at the same time. I had been working in the women's prison here in Washington as a volunteer, but I hadn't been going into the men's prison, I don't think, until, like Devin said, Catherine Beckett invited me to come meet with the Black Prisoners Caucus and the CLO, which was the Concerned Lifers organization, to talk about restorative justice. I think, you know, 2, 3, 5, 10 years prior, I would have never imagined that that is the work I'd be doing. I came up with a lot of proximity to the justice system. I've had my family members and close friends get arrested and convicted and serve time. But the work I was primarily doing when I was growing up was around sort of women and violence and labor. And it wasn't until I went through the justice system as a survivor first, and then very shortly after as a defendant, facing a 15 to life sentence for crimes that were very, very connected to my own survivorship, that I got like radically politicized around mass incarceration. And yeah, I mean, I think I was young. I was 19, 20 when I had that experience. I was in college. I'd read a lot about all forms of sort of oppression and injustice, and I still was not prepared for the level of sort of dehumanizing, traumatizing impact on my own body that that experience had. And I just experienced the criminal legal system before I had the language fully to understand it. I experienced it as just woefully insufficient and deeply harmful. And at the time in my life, I mean, I think for me, what happened was that I felt so clear that it wasn't offering the things that I know that I needed as a survivor, that I know that the person who harmed me needed, and that I needed as a person struggling, as a young person that was struggling as a defendant either. At no point did someone stop and say, "Hey, what's going on in your life that led you to this point? And what do you need?" Right? Those aren't the questions that are asked. And so I had sort of just like a deep gut response and a real clarity in sort of like my soul and my body before I had political clarity, that that's not where I thought that our resources should be going. And so I walked away from those experiences with that deep felt sense that just criminalization as a frontline approach to addressing harm is insufficient. And ultimately my survivorship was believed and my harm doing was sort of, I was granted mercy. I did community supervision for 8 years. I went on to graduate from college. I attended law school. And I found out later that less than like 1% of people get what I ended up getting in my sentence. And so not only did I have like a real clear sense about survivorship and about like the injustices of the criminal legal system, but I also felt really clear about the fact that the criminal legal system is targeting Black, Indigenous, and Latinx people, and that the experiences that those folks have and that low-income people have who are cycled through the system daily just pales in comparison to the level of harm that I experience. And that really set me on a path toward thinking about, like, how can I walk away from this experience and not do something about it? Like, how can I walk away and just go get a regular job? And so I went full force into racial justice organizing work and work with people who were incarcerated. And then on the side was doing work with survivors. And I had seen for a very long time, I saw those sort of calls to task as separate. I saw those movements as separate. It wasn't until I found restorative justice and transformative justice that I sort of felt at home in a movement that was deeply committed to the dignity and humanity of people on all sides of harm. And that's where I've stayed ever since. And I see that work as a commitment, not just to the individuals and to the communities that are experiencing harm, but also as a strategy, a political strategy of decolonization and undoing white supremacy in our communities and in our justice systems.
Thank you, Martina. That's an incredible story and deeply moving. This is Justice Radio, and this is Catherine Besteman. Today I'm talking with Martina Cartman and Devin Adams about their work with Collective Justice. I'd like to follow up with that final point, Martina, that you were making about what TJ and RJ offer. TJ and RJ being deeply committed to dignity and the humanity of all people on all sides of harm, something you feel that you personally did not experience in the criminal legal system and that you, the folks who you work with, do not experience in the criminal legal system. And so can you briefly give us an overview of what TJ and RJ in your experience offers to people both who have caused harm and who have experienced harm that the criminal legal system does not?
Yeah, absolutely. Restorative and transformative justice, I'm using them a little bit interchangeably because our work is informed by both, but they are movements that came out of two different places and times in history. So I want to name that they are separate and very complementary movements that are both concerned with building the capacity to respond to and repair in the aftermath of harm in a way that centers the relationships and the actual impacts of harm, as opposed to just sort of the rules or regulations or laws that were broken, that moves from a punishment system to a system of accountability that actually, what we don't say like hold someone accountable, but we say create the conditions that make that accountability possible. So really thinking about like, how can we as a community move from shame and punishment to a place where someone is invited into an accountability process? And that invitation is actually compelling, right? Where the concept of accountability is a concept that is liberatory, that is tangible, that actually meets the needs of somebody who has been impacted by harm in a really like specific way. And that's the beauty of restorative and transformative justice. It's not, you know, the harm that you cause fits under this category and comes with this sentence, and that should be sufficient for your healing. But instead, a real question, like we actually go to survivors and say, what is it that you need? And sometimes that answer is, I want to hear accountability. I want to hear it. I'm sorry. Sometimes it is, I don't want to hear anything. I want to share what the impact of this harm has been on me. I want to feel heard. I want to feel seen. And sometimes there are actual actions, right? Like there are specific things that I need to feel whole again. And so there's a whole range, and that's what RJ and TJ opens up, is the possibility to respond to that range. The last thing I'd say is that the idea of restorative and transformative justice is rooted in a concept of stakeholders having agency. So people that are closely impacted by the harm, whether they've caused it, whether they've experienced, or are close family members and loved ones, that there's actually an opportunity to take part in deciding what needs to be done. And when you have experienced harm, like the core experience of survivorship is that there is not a sense of agency, right? When someone causes you harm, aside from physical and emotional impact, there is just a core component of it is that you didn't have a choice in that, right? Like no one chooses to experience harm. And so part of the effect of restorative transformative justice is that we get to restore a sense of agency. And so even as little as like, I get to choose where I meet somebody and what that meeting looks like and what we eat and what we talk about and how fast the pace is that we move. That's all a part of regenerating a sense of safety and agency. And so often like a restorative process doesn't come to a point where two people meet. So often like we do that and someone's like, I feel complete actually, like having gotten to be heard and moved through that process. So the power of restorative and transformative justice is it the possibility to be really responsive to specific needs. And I think that's also part of what makes it hard for us when we start talking about like scaling and that kind of thing, because it's not just a one size fits all approach, but the core values are the same, right? Like the fundamental values of how we move with a restorative and transformative justice process are consistent. And then the modalities, the ways we do that are culturally specific and hyper-local. And that's what makes it so powerful and what the criminal legal system can never do. I think the very last thing I'll say about the criminal legal system is that it equates accountability with punishment. And in doing so, I think Deb can speak to this better than me, but we've talked about, like, in doing so, punishment becomes this, it's a deeply painful and traumatic process, but a passive one, right? So someone is sentenced and is told to go serve their time. And then we're like, great, they were accountable, they did their time. I mean, I don't think we actually ever say that they were accountable. I think we continue to punish people forever, but we say, like, that is sufficient. And we pretend that that is accountability. But accountability is first an internal process. It starts with yourself. And it's a process that we choose into every day that is much, much more active and difficult in terms of rigor than the passive process of punishment, because it actually requires that people step into deep discomfort to figure out what the underlying issues are that I'm having in my own life. What are the underlying behaviors that led to the harm itself? And what are the conditions around me that need to change? And that is a lifelong process. And so it's a really different relationship to accountability, a really different understanding of what accountability means.
Thank you. That's super, super helpful. And I think also a reminder to those of us in Maine that we have to be really attentive to the specifics of our situation. And of course, Maine is incredibly diverse in all kinds of ways. So we're going to get to that in a moment. But first, I want to come to Devin and I want to ask, what are the potential problems or shortcomings with an RJ or TJ approach in the wake of harm? I mean, everything that Martina has said, I'm like, sign me up. I'm a survivor. I want all those things. But it can't work so well all of the time. And so I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about where the gaps are or where the breakdowns are, and how does an organization like yours deal with those?
Yeah, I think one of the things that you realize is that, you know, there's no guaranteed outcomes, I think was mentioned before. You know, whether you're on the responsible party or the folks who have experienced harm, you know, you enter and you engage in this process, and there's really no promise of, you know, closure or whatever the thing is that the harm party might be seeking. And that can be tough sometimes, especially when we think about how we've been conditioned because of the current legal system, that there is finality in something. And so making sure that we're holding people well through that process and working with them and coming up with alternatives that they can be satisfied with. But it's definitely a challenge. And I think we have so many cultures that are going on in the community, like that exist within community, that have different experiences and expectations of outcomes when harms occur. Yeah, I think there's all types of conditioning that goes on with that. Like people, just communication barriers, all of those things present challenges. And, you know, we have to, I think that's the beauty about CJ though. And I think for all of us is like having diversity in your community and finding folks that are willing to show up and practice in ways that are bridge builders and can bring cultures together. But in the interim, yeah, they're definitely challenges. Another thing is someone who's involved with fundraising, like it requires a lot of resources. I think when we, again, there's a very linear process with the legal system, and we can kind of forecast how long a person will be in the court system and the costs associated with that. When it comes to healing work, for some people, it could be 3 months. For another person, it might be 3 years, and we have to be okay with that. And we need to support those folks no matter what they're going through. And that's for folks on both sides. And then, you know, the staff and the facilitating team and all of the community needs to be healed well. Because, I mean, who's helping support the healers, right? The healers and those that are healed, they both need levels of support. And then I think there's this expectation that RJ is going to be the end-all, be-all panacea. And that's not really what we're claiming to be. It's just this is something that solves for some of the serious harms that we're experiencing and that what we're seeing, but it doesn't answer for all things. And to be okay with that, you know, there's some folks that work in different, that are engaged in different areas of the work. And like, we're just focused on the things that we can change and that we can fix. But yeah, I would just say like culture, the expense, the timeline, no guaranteed outcomes, I think are all, you know, some challenges that we experience. And that's okay. I think, again, I just would encourage people not to be discouraged by those challenges, but to focus more on like what is possible when thinking about holding people well through trauma.
What I love about what you just articulated is, in my experience, most people who are critical of RJ are critical because they claim there's no accountability in RJ. And what I'm hearing from both of you is it's all about accountability. That's the whole point. The challenge is not getting to accountability. The challenge is these other issues that you've named, which are kind of more logistical issues.
Yeah.
Dimensions of healing from harm and looking deep into yourself to understand why you may have caused harm.
If I could add, like, just in this conversation and something like when we talk about it like accountability is a real thing. And it was harder to actually name the thing because, like, in this process through HEAL, we write an accountability letter. And it's not just in the isolation. It's in a group of about 15 other people that share similar experiences. But the hardest thing for me to do was to be fully transparent and talk about what was leading up to this thing, to the harm that happened, what actually happened, who was impacted, what it might look like to actually to make repair. Like the level of intentionality and focus and commitment to being fully transparent in all of those aspects of what I just described requires a lot of yourself. And when you compare that to the legal system, which gives you a sentence that's probably doesn't fit, is excessive, and then we call that accountability, what happens, what I've witnessed as someone who's formerly incarcerated, is people take on this mindset of like, I did my time, I don't owe anybody anything. Or there's a huge level of resentment around the amount of time. And so you never get at accountability, and not in a way that's meaningful where folks are actually changing the way they're showing up, but when offered a different way and then being supported through being transparent and actually practicing accountability, your life changes. It's literally transformational. And then when you compare that to what the system offers, and you want to go by numbers or anecdotes, there's a clear contrast and there's a clear difference in outcome.
That's a great note to end on. Thank you so much. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, and to Luke Brown and Aaron Pyle, our sound engineers, I'm Catherine Besteman. We are Justice Radio.